give a warm Tulare County welcome for our 10-minute speaker, Ann.
Thank you. My name is Ann. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm from Fresno. I didn't raise my hand as a visitor because I figured you'd all get to meet me right here. I am married to the main speaker, which is as much of a surprise to both of us as it may be to anybody else. I started drinking when I was 12, and I drank Red Mountain, and I started right at the top. Pagan Pink, Ripple, 79 cents a bottle. It was quite sophisticated. And I was born and raised in San Mateo, California, and that's a little south of San Francisco. I was in seventh grade during the Summer of Love, and we had a lot of fun. I drank like a pig from the beginning. There was not a little line that I, you don't start drinking at 12 and become a social drinker. It just doesn't work that way. And we spent a lot of time in the basement of my house and, making a lot of noise and doing a lot of damage. I never got in trouble. I went to high school. I chose my college as there was a book called The Underground Guide to the College of Your Choice, and it told you the relationship of men to women, the odds and the what drugs were available. You could start, and I went to the University of Colorado, which was the number one party school in the country, and you could drink at 18. And so they had these little beer bars. And so that's how I collected my college. I don't know if any of you collected your college any other way, but that's what I did. I made every decision in my life based on alcohol, based on its accessibility, based on how I would get it, where I would get it, and, what I would do. And I loved drinking. I loved it. And when I came back to California after I graduated college, never got a DUI. I got pulled over one time on the 280 going from my cousin's in San Francisco to the beach. And I was on 280. I had a glass of wine sitting on the console. I don't even drink wine. I don't know, but I also didn't travel without alcohol, so I had wine. And so I was driving, and a cop pulled me over. And I threw my giant hat over the wine glass, and so I don't know what he said. Don't drive so fast. And I said, okay. Oh, where are you going in such a hurry? And I said, the beach. And oh, okay, well, I'm off. And I said, okay, me too, see ya. It was, one of those strange encounters on the highway. And, I didn't have those kinds of consequences. I did have, I got married to the guy that I never dated, I got married to my current person. From Colorado, I dragged him back to California with me when I was going to school, and we ended up getting married. Well, I ended up getting pregnant, and then we ended up getting married. And it was just all very mysterious. I never thought I was going to get married, and when I moved to Fresno, two kids later, and Art and I had been in a relationship by that time for, we met in the 80s, and I got sober in, did I say that already? November 9th, 1988, and in 1992 I moved to Fresno, which was not on my little list of things that I wanted to do in sobriety. You know, I got sober in San Francisco and ended up in Fresno because I got a great job and was able to buy a house and bring my kids, and I was divorced from my husband. I used to say, and my husband, my current husband doesn't necessarily like it, but I picked my first sponsor the way I picked the men in my life, and that was because she was sitting next to me. And that was how I made all my decisions, you know. Oh, okay, you're the one? All right, off we go. And that was, but we had, but Art was completely different. We had real things in common. And anyway, that husband, our attorney advised us that we should buy a house so that we'd have something to split up in the divorce. So we did. And then we established a relationship. In 92, I moved to Fresno. Like I said, that was not on my list of things that I wanted to have happen. But I got here. I had 4 years sober at that time. I had worked the steps with my sponsor. You know, and I still do. Today, or yesterday, we had an office meeting, and we got told, I worked for the feds, and we got told that we were going to have furlough days, and I was pissed. I don't want my income reduced by 10%. You know, what I did was I went in my office. Well, I ranted a little bit, told them that I thought the method was stupid. That's always the word you want to use with the interim boss, you know. Stupid. That's stupid. I know you made the decision, but that's stupid. Then I went into my office and I called my sponsor. Because even at almost 25 years sober, I can shoot off at the mouth, but I can't. It's better for me to make decisions based in the book, based in sponsorship, based in a spiritual search, you know, take a breath. I can give really good advice, but I'm still the one that yells out in the meeting, well, that's pretty stupid. And, oh, we're on a telephone, you know, the guy who's on the TV, I've never even met this guy. The love of my life. When we got married, when I took my job here in Fresno, I had mentioned to all my coworkers, because I do blurt a bit, that if I ever mention, say that I'm going to get married, shoot me, and because the other marriage didn't end well, and ended up paying the taxes and blah blah blah. But so when we were going to get married, we had this. I work in the federal courthouse, and had the judge and said, "Well, we'll be behind the magnetometer, so none of the people that I asked to shoot me can actually do so." So, but we were both as surprised as I, you know, when we met, we were not the two people that you would nominate for, you know, we've been married now for 15 years, and that was also not on my list of things that I had expected or hoped for when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is my pleasure to be down here and to share the story that I got to participate in for quite some time. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, give a warm round of applause for our featured speaker, Art.
Yeah, I've got notes and everything. My name is Art. I'm an alcoholic. Whenever I speak, which isn't very often, I like to start out with a quote from page 568 of the big book that we live by. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Certainly not me, that's Herbert Spencer. I'm sure you've all heard that before. I'm born and raised in San Francisco, California. I come from a nest of alcoholics and drug addicts. By the time I was 9 years old, I was drinking pretty regularly, every weekend. My parents were party people. You know, they worked 5 days a week. They were functioning alcoholics. During the week, my mother drank a six-pack of Olympia and a pint of Ballerina vodka every night. My father was a bar drinker, so I don't know exactly what he took in during the week, but by the time he got home, he was shit-faced, you know? So I have an older sister, and as with most dysfunctional families, she hasn't spoken to me in 25 years. That's what comes from dysfunction. Started drinking at 9, did my first substance at 15, and I didn't stop till I was 56. So if you do the math, I drank and used for 47 years. And it is only through the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm even standing here today. Let me go back to the beginnings of it. I started drinking. My parents, when they had these weekend parties, they rolled up the carpet. They had the hi-fi going. There was an open bar for 30 or 40 people. Everybody was smoking. Some people were doing other things. I ended up going into the basement with the girl next door who was a couple years older than me. And we drank whiskey that we had stolen from upstairs. Got sick. Both of us. She went to her garage where her father kept beer that he made in the basement. We drank some more of that, got sick. And then she went upstairs and I went next door and went to bed. Every time my parents partied, I partied. I would even sometimes, when I got to be 12, 13, invite guys from my class at St. Anne's Grammar School to come over for the weekend because nobody paid any attention to what I was doing or saying. You know, all they did was get drunk. My father was in law enforcement. This does not add to the party. It just means that someone with an armed weapon is in the home. And so you never know, you know. You never know. My mother was born in Helper, Utah. She was a Mormon. Her whole family consisted of Mormon people. When she married my father, who was a Catholic, she had to sign a document indicating that she would rear any children of the marriage in the Catholic Church and make sure that they were educated in Catholicism. I think that pissed off the Mormon. She was a bitter, physical, emotional, verbal abuser. And my father was a bar drinker, so by the time he got home, he was pretty much fucked up. He'd sit down in the chair and find himself someplace to lie down and go to sleep. My mother, on the other hand, was not that way. So, I graduated from St. Anne's. I must have been 12, I guess, 13 years old. I was an altar boy, of course. My mother had to drive me to Mass every morning when I served Mass, which I'm sure pissed her off even more. So I graduated from St. Anne's. They enrolled me in a very prestigious boys high school in San Francisco, St. Ignatius High School, was an all-boys school. I never spent any time in the classroom with a girl until I was 16 years old. First year at SI, I always did well academically. I had no problem with the studies part, but I was a chronic mouth infection. When the Jesuits told me to sit down, I like to stand up just to see what the puppies do. And they do the same thing every time. You know? Just like my mother. They would swat me and punish me in some form. So I ended up getting kicked out of there in the first year of high school. Fortunately or unfortunately, I had an uncle who was in local politics, and he arranged a second year at this Catholic high school. At the end of that year, I got kicked out again, and they wouldn't take me back. And that was okay with me. I didn't care for it very much anyway. A lot of the fellows there had money, and you know, we didn't gel well, although we did some weekend drinking. So I went to a public school right up the street from my home, Abraham Lincoln High School, and I found out right away, you know, they have a homeroom in the public schools in those days, and when I reported to the homeroom in my St. Ignatius student jacket, I got into an altercation with another student on the first day, and I was in the principal's office the first day there. I made it at Lincoln for a year, and they threw me out of there. So I was given an ultimatum by my mother. I was closing in on, I was 17 or so, 16, 17. Either finish up a year at Drew Prepartment, which was a prep school, and stay in the house, or we're going to kick you out. Well, you know, I really had no place to go, although at this point I did have a job. I was delivering a prescription for a pharmacy. Great place to put a junkie and a drunk. Now, I'm talking about the 50s, okay? Now, in the 50s, if you wanted to get some Seroquel that had drugs in it, or terpenhydrate with codeine that came in these little clear bottles, all you had to do was walk into the drugstore and sign your name and put your address. And they'd sell you the bottle of this stuff. Well, I didn't buy any, but I got plenty. The drugstore also sold alcohol, so you know, I was like the most popular guy in the area because I could get booze and I could get drugs. And I wasn't even 18 years old. So, you know, I graduated from Drew Preparatory. I did leave the house. My mother and I had a very strenuous and physical argument on the way out, and I broke her arm leaving the house. Never did go back there. I moved in with my sister, who had recently married, lived in her basement for a while, do odd jobs. You know, I'm an academic, I'm a student, so I ended up going to City College, the two-year program. I spent 4 years doing two. I got into surfing, started going to the beach, we started smoking pot, pretty soon we're going to Mexico, we're coming back with, you know, bales or, you know, kibble dabbing and that kind of import-export business, right? So by the time I'm done at City College, I transfer over to San Francisco State University. I had great grades. And the man across the street from me who was a former professional boxer and a great person, had a little half boxing ring in his basement and a workout area and stuff. He was a captain in the San Francisco Fire Department. And he knew pretty much what was going on in my home. He was aware of the abuse. In those days, people did not intervene. It wasn't the kind of thing that you, like today, you know, the kid would call the cops on his own parents or whatever. But, you know, I thought it was a normal way to live. I thought that's the way people lived. I had not been exposed to other people living any kind of normal life. So, you know, by the time I hit the street, I had a large chip on my shoulder, and I had a very bad attitude. And these two things don't combine for a good time, especially when you're drinking and using. So anyway, I finish up the city, I go to San Francisco State. The man across the street, unbeknownst to me, signed me up for the exam for the San Francisco Fire Department. I'm sleeping in my sister's basement one Saturday. I'm hungover. You know, we're out till 2 or 3 in the morning. This guy comes through the door. He wakes me up. Come on, we're going down to take the fireman test. Huh? So anyway, he puts me in the car. We get on to Mission High School. I take the fireman test. I scored number 27 on the list. Pretty soon, in 1966, I'm sworn in as a San Francisco fireman. To give you a little bit of background on the fire department, at that point in time, I think I was 22 years old, just short of 22. So it was 1966, around that time. The fire department was well known for being very aggressive, putting out fires, and also for lots of drinking on the job. These guys, you know, I'm an ace player. I loved running into the burning buildings when other people were coming out. But I didn't like to do it in an altered state. So I went through 11, 12 years of firefighting without drinking while I was working, while these other people, most of them anyway, were pretty heavy drinkers. But I made up for that because we only worked 9 days a month. And, you know, so I had plenty of time for my extracurricular activities. And at this point, we had switched colors. We were no longer doing green things from Mexico. We were doing white stuff from Central and South America. We were doing some importation from Thailand of what they used to call Thai sticks. I don't know if anybody remembers Thai sticks, but they were a very strong form of marijuana that people in Thailand grew, and we started bringing that in by the container. And anyway, that was the kind of business stuff that I got involved in. In the meantime, I went to law school at night. I got a law degree. It took me 3 times to pass the bar, which can tell you right away that you don't have to be very smart to be a lawyer. You just have to be tenacious. Okay, name of the game. Not a very smart guy. Academically, I do okay, but testing is not my forte. So now, I'm a fireman. I have a wife. I have 3 children. I'm running drugs. And I'm going to law school. So, to call me a high achiever, regardless of the event, you know, would be an understatement. I mean, looking back on this shit now, I don't know, I have no idea how I did this, you know, I'm sure the drugs helped, but I really wasn't that heavy into, of course I was in control at that point, you know. I was in control, yeah. You know, I could control myself so if I did a line, I could drink 4 more hours, you know. Anyway, I did get through law school, I did pass the bar eventually. I did open a little office. I maintained a job in the fire department, had a wife, had 3 kids, bought a beautiful home with a view of the ocean. And this young lady that I married, who has since passed, you know, what I did in that first marriage was I picked someone who had some weaknesses in their personality, and I took that person captive. And I formulated her life for her for a good number of years. But I will say that with the 3 kids out of that marriage, she was very good with them. And I was not. I was not available to them on a personal level. I gave them plenty of money. I bought them anything they wanted. But I had no father-son or father-daughter time for my own children because, you know, I was terminally unique. I was a lawyer, I was a drug dealer, I was a fireman, I was a husband, I was a father, you know, blah, blah, blah. You can't put all those balls up in the air and keep them. It doesn't happen. Stuff starts falling down, you know. The wheels come off the train. My first wife, her father was a doctor. He was also an alcoholic and a pill freak. He used to do the heparin with codeine so frequently that the corners of his mouth were always white. Yeah. And what they did to try and control me was they sent me to a woman's house over in Marin County for a little dry out session. You know, I stayed there for a couple of days. Made a phone call and had a guy deliver drugs, and that was the end of that. You know, so at this point, I'm addicted to cocaine. I'm an alcoholic. People that I'm working with are starting to get arrested in foreign countries. who's the first guy to go and get them.
Hello.
I had not, other than going to the islands once, I don't think by the time I was 30 I had left the continental United States. But my first trip was to Thailand, and I extricated a guy from a jail over there for a healthy fee, all first class air, all first class hotel. And the thing is, once you leave the States, you find out in all foreign countries that I'm involved with, that all it takes to get people out is money, okay, and time. Sometimes you have to be patient. I'm not a patient man. I didn't, so I spent money instead of leaving. But anyway, I started to get a reputation in San Francisco for being able to go to these places and fuck these people. And so I started doing that, and in my travels, I ran into some very interesting people. One of the groups that I ran into, a young man was from this area, his name was Larry Hillbloom. I don't know if that does anything for you, but Hillbloom is the H in DHL, which is a courier service that does round-the-world document delivery. Well, trust me, that's not how they started out. Larry is, he passed on now, but anyway, another one of my jobs, I mean, to be candid with you, I never had a real job until I was 55, 56 years old, but another one of my jobs was representing DHL, and I mean, they paid me an incredible amount of monthly money to do whatever I was doing. Which really had very little to do with legal work, but had more to do with going places and getting people extricated from foreign jails. I did that for 15, 16 years. I was returning on a flight from Colombia, and the man who sat next to me was dressed in a nice suit and tie, and you know, I was okay. I had cocaine on my person. I was drinking alcohol on the plane. You could still smoke then. I was smoking. I remember smoking. And I noticed the guy had a signet ring on his little pinky finger with initials, let's say ABC. And we started chatting and he gave me a business card. And it didn't say ABC on it. It said that he was some kind of an official for Pizza Hut International, which, you know, we all knew at that point was a CIA front. And this man and I had a conversation for a couple of minutes. I did change my seat after we had the conversation. And he suggested to me that he wasn't on the airplane by accident, that he knew exactly what I had done in Medellin. And, you know, I was a suspect and going to be named in an indictment. So that was my last trip to any foreign country to get anyone out of jail. It was not my last trip, if you know what I mean. I continued using drugs and alcohol heavily. I met Ann. We ended up working in San Francisco on a pretty major lawsuit involving some people with a lot of money and a home in Pacific Heights or things like that. But I was able to maintain, for whatever reason, my reputation in San Francisco as being a pretty good litigator. And, you know, so I had no trouble really getting business. I was just fucked up most of the time, so I didn't want to service the business, you know. I was like in camera chest, but didn't really want to do the work. I met Ann. Ann was a delightful meet in my life, but I also had my own, reason behind reason, motive behind the motive. You know, Ann is very bright. She does terrific research. And once I left law school, I really started to work on law book. I was pretty good on my feet, but reading that shit really bored me. So if you have someone smart who can read that stuff, I guess they analyze it and put it out for you, black print on white paper, you know, all you have to be is some kind of idiot that can read. You're telling me again, or, you know. And I could do that, and, you know, I always looked nice, always had a beautiful suit and all that kind of shit. So anyway, I continued my career. My wife told me she was going to divorce me. This was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if it was a weeknight or a weekend. I had just come home from who knows where, and I was driving, I'll never forget, I was driving a Jensen, beautiful sports car, because we always had nice cars. She said she was going to divorce me. I called up Red Ball Movies at 3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, was told that it would cost, I don't get it, what kind of cost, you know, get them over here now, I got to get my shit out of here. So I, at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, big band comes from out, kids are up, they're all crying, the neighbors' lights are going on, you know. A typical chaotic, drunken, addicted evening. So anyway, I moved most of my clothing and stuff into the Red Ball van. This home I purchased was a three-story place, had a basement, had a first floor, and then had a second floor. And the second floor had a stairway that wound up, and then at the end of the stairway, down on the bottom, there were these two pieces of wood on one of those posts, you know, right? But before I moved into the place, and when I looked at it, I had a friend of mine who was a master carpenter come and take the top of the post off, hollow it out, and then put it in reverse so you could, you know, that's how we used to smuggle through. So I also remember at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning that I had 8 kilos in the thing of the stairway, so I had to go back and get those. This didn't make my wife very happy. Anyway, we did go through that divorce. As I say, she came from, you know, she came from money. She, her father was a doctor. Her mother was part of the Phillips Petroleum family, and they were both serious alcoholics. 2 days before we went for our final decree of dissolution, she inherited almost $1 million from her mother, who had passed about a year earlier. So I, you know, I had a pretty slick lawyer, and she didn't have a lawyer, and I ended up walking away from that thing by just giving her the house and all the payments of any kind. So anyway, my life continued as an attorney in San Francisco. I was on the downhill slide. When Ann and I first met, I had a beautiful set of offices on Post Street, 1301 Post, and a really nice plus space, had a wet bar, had a little apartment next to it, had a closet, you know, with 2 or 3 locks on it where all the drugs were kept. It was a kind of a fun place to work. So after, let's see, we left the country around then, right? We had a baby, Hank. In 1996, Hank died in a soccer accident in Fresno. He was 10 years old. He ran into a metal goalpost between heartbeats, and before he hit the ground, he was dead. I was still having too much fun up in the Bay Area when the phone rang in my, I'll never forget that car. I was driving this Cadillac, maroon Cadillac with a white Landau top, like a tip car. But it had a stationary thing for the phone, and I saw a phone would ring, so I pushed the button, you know, and I could hear a siren in the background, and I could hear Ann's voice, and, you know, and she told me over the phone that Hank had died. And you would think a person in his 50s who, you know, upon hearing that, you know, did whatever he had to do and headed toward Fresno, when he got to Fresno, would do something other than go into the bathroom, snort a line, and take a drink before he looked at the body. But that's not what this person did. You know, I went in the bathroom, I did a line, took a drink, and then looked at the body. You know, because I didn't have the backbone to participate or help other people at that point in my life. But one of the turning points that occurred around this time was that I watched what Alcoholics Anonymous was and how they surrounded Ann. These people moved into her home literally. They didn't stay overnight. I did, you know, for whatever good I was. But they came into the house. They cleaned the house. They did all the cooking. They did the gardening. They answered the phones. It was like, you know, I mean, I come from a dysfunctional family, and I've seen a few functional families, and they didn't really appeal to me much, but when I saw the people of Alcoholics Anonymous surround this woman who had just lost a child and support her in that way, I started to think that, maybe this is a little more than some kind of bullshit outfit, you know? I mean, I knew about AA. I had a cousin who was 33 years old when I was about 19 who fell off a bar stool at a place called the Florentine Gardens, 19th Avenue and Noriega Street in San Francisco, and died of alcoholism in the bar. My mother's sister, Mag, who lived in Mojave, my sister and I used to take the train down there for the summers, she eventually moved to Marin County and lived in a cottage behind my mother's house, and she died of a pill overdose. You know, so I knew what two and two was with drugs, but, you know, I was indestructible. Besides that, you know, I was terminally unique, so who's going to fuck with me? You know? Well, after about 43, 44 years of drinking and using, I started to get sick. I have a pretty strong physical plant, or I wouldn't be here to begin with, but I started to get sick. I drank and then I'd vomit, and, you know, I couldn't hold it down. I'd have to wait a day, and that was really hard. And, you know, toward the end, I was vomiting multicolored yellows, greens, and reds. The red stuff was blood. There was blood coming out of my stool. I had untreated type 2 diabetes for about 10 years. I had cellulitis. So I looked like the Michelin Man in red. I weighed about 280 pounds. I was so infected and so puffed up that when I went to Kaiser, they had to slice me here and put a port in my neck. You know, because at Kaiser, they'd give you the antibiotics and say, shoot them up at home. I never had a problem with needles either. So anyway, thank God that Ann had medical coverage, put me on her medical coverage, and saved my life. You know, they told me after doing a few blood tests and taking a look at me that if I didn't stop doing what I was doing and living the way I was living, that the first thing they were going to do would be amputate my left foot. And like I say, you know, I'm terminally unique. I have a very large ego. I could not picture myself with a prosthesis, you know. So I went back to the house. I finished everything in the house in 3 or 4 days. All the alcohol, all the drugs, because I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. And then I stopped on my own because I didn't need you, you know. I didn't want to be around you. I knew Ann was going to meetings. I met people from AA. They seemed like wonderful people. But, you know, my terminal uniqueness was almost sufficient to kill me. So I did the first year of white knuckling. No meetings, no support, no sponsor, no steps, no nothing. I sweated through a couch. Had to be replaced. I mean, I was pretty sick. And it took me about 3 months just to kind of stabilize, you know, so I could kind of get clear and see where I was and what I was doing. We had a couple of dogs at the time, and they were my friends. You know, nobody else talked to me. Ann had another son, Robert, who was in the house, and I walked by the bedroom one time. One of the things I used to do when I'd get loaded is I'd ask Ann to get me McRibs whenever in season. I mean, I couldn't think right now of eating shit like that, but I needed the sugar real badly because I was an untreated type 2 diabetic. I couldn't figure that out. Anyway, so the first year was horrible, but I didn't drink, I didn't use. So I started to go to these meetings, you know. And I'm still, you know, a chronic malcontent. I went through 6 sponsors in the first year. Because people tell me what to do, and then I think to myself, well, Jesus, you know, you're smarter than this asshole. Why don't you do it this way? Do it your way. Which never worked. You know, which got me here. You know? My deck thinking got me right here. But I still, you know, wasn't ready to fully listen until I got a friend of Reyes's for a sponsor, who was a medical doctor. And, you know, I was still kind of paranoid. I'd been involved in a lot of shady transactions. And I wasn't about to tell these country boys from Fresno that, you know, I had some real secrets in my past. And I wasn't about to share them with those people. But when I met Dr. Mike, he came over to my house. He asked me to kneel down and say a prayer with him. And my best thinking clicked in again, and I said, shit, you know, I went through all that stuff in grammar school with these goddamn priests who were, you know, fucking with my friends. You know how that turned out. But then I said, for some reason, why not? I mean, what have I got to lose? So I knelt down and said a prayer with him. And he asked me to say the words, asking God to relieve me of my addiction and my alcoholism and my desire to drink and use. And we started working the steps that very same day. Now, I didn't take long. Once I started to nod my head yes, you know, I got the picture that everything in AA is about yes, not about no. Whatever they ask you to do in this program, you just say yes. Well, that was almost 14 years ago. I'll be 14 years clean and sober in April. And one of the things I did for the first 6 years was I spent every Tuesday night at Avenal State Prison, bringing a meeting into the prison there. And then I took some time off from that, but the other commitment I have is at the 11th hour for many years on Friday nights. I used to bring a panel in there and talk to people who are trying to clean up and get sober. And the last couple of years, I've been going down to Pleasant Valley on the third Thursday of the month with a group of men from the Rule 62 meeting, which is my home group. So, by the time I cleaned up after that year and started going to meetings, there was a lawyer in one of the meetings I went to, and I walked up to him and asked him if he could get me a job. I had never had a job. I mean, a fireman is a great thing to be. In the time that I was a fireman, there were no masks involved. There was no safety shit involved. The place was on fire. We went in and put the fire out. Didn't matter. You know? Things are different now, and they should be, because I'm sure it didn't do a lot of the people that I worked with any good when they were dying from lung cancer. But that's another story. Okay, where was I? Where am I? So anyway, I asked the guy if he'd get me a job, and he said, well, I can get you an interview. You'll have to get the job for yourself. So, went on the interview, and a guy named John Barker, who has it, or had a law firm, he since sold it to another lawyer, but it's still in operation. I still work there. I went to work for these people, I think it's 14 years ago. And I took a year away from there because I had a conflict with a supervising attorney. And but what I did during that year was I got a job as the director of comprehensive addiction programs up on Weisbridge in Fresno. So I was the director of a sober living inpatient care program for a year. And what a great experience that was for a drunk like me. Because they had the only free detox in Fresno, we saw the worst and the best, you know, the worst coming in, and usually coming in, and coming in, and coming in. But the best went through the program, and I saw some of my closest friends. So, okay. What it was like was fast and hard for a good number of years. What happened was I got so sick I couldn't use or drink anymore. And the way it's been since then is miraculous. Those three kids that didn't talk to me for years because I was drunk, bloated, didn't pay attention to them, are back in my life. I have five grandchildren who've never seen me drink or use. A sixth one on the way in September, coming in September. And we'll be back there for the birth. I still work for the same law firm. I do not work, I have this incredible job. I work in juvenile dependency. There's two parts to juvenile law: delinquency, when you commit a crime if you're under 18, and dependency is when you're abused and neglected in your own home, and CPS comes and plucks you, and they put you in a foster home, guardianship, or adoption. I'm a lawyer in dependency court. Half my caseload are minors and the other half are parents, and what we try and do there is offer these families services so that they can reunify. So whatever the problem might be in a family, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sexual molestation or domestic violence, you know, any variety, number of things, the state of California is very generous and they offer these people programs to reunite their families free of charge. All they have to do is show up. Pretty good deal. Unfortunately, most of the people who go through the system are not successful in their reunification, so that results in a lot of kids being in guardianships and the fortunate ones being adopted. You know, for me, working in juvenile dependency is just like going back to my house at 1911 22nd Avenue when I was a kid. You know, I see these people come in, I can definitely pick out the female abusers. But I'm able to use my legal skills to try to reunite these broken units, and it turns out some pretty satisfying work. I did that. Well, first I started out doing criminal defense with them for 4 or 5 years and felony jury trials, and then I switched over to the dependency because as a result of the type 2 diabetes, I have what's called diabetic neuropathy, so I can't feel my feet most of the time. So if I get a cut or sore on my foot, I don't know it's there. Anne and I were in New York visiting our son who lives in Brooklyn, and I was wearing a pair of flip-flops getting on the subway, and there was some kind of sharp object that I didn't see or feel. The object cut into my foot. The man next to me said, "Hey man, your foot's bleeding," and you know, there was a big puddle of blood around my foot. So anyway, we went, you know, to a pharmacy, we got all the bullshit wrapped up my foot. When I came back to Fresno, my podiatrist at Kaiser made a suggestion to me. His brother is a Superior Court judge, and he said, "Hey, you ought to check out juvenile dependency because they don't get up in juvenile dependency, they sit down. So you won't have to be walking on your foot all the time." Anyway, that's why I ended up there. My foot healed up. I'm pretty happy with what I do. I work Tuesdays and Wednesdays only. I'm very seldom there afternoon. And, you know, they pay me a nice piece of change to do that. None of these things with those children, the grandchildren, the employment, my marriage, for the love of my life, and the woman who saved my life, would be possible without these rooms and the people in them. So, I lived a pretty interesting life. I never wanted for drugs, alcohol, money, any of those things that we call material things. But I always had a hole in my soul, you know? I mean, it's just, I really didn't give a shit about anybody else but me. And, you know, I attributed that to my mother for a long time, and then I had to kind of deal with that and say, hey, you know, I started out that way, but you're 55 years old now, you know? I was fucking grown up, you know? Anyway, so I started to suit up, show up, and do things for other people as opposed to constantly spending time thinking about me. And, you know, that's what the programs taught me to do. And if it wasn't a substantially better way to live than the other way I was living, I wouldn't be here. But I can tell you, if you're new or fairly new, and you're desperate for something to change in your life, this is the place to get it done. And it's very simple. It's a simple program. And my motto throughout the 14 years is KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. I do the same thing every day that people told me to do when I first got here. I get up in the morning, you know, I thank my higher power for another day. I do some reading and meditation. I have a series of prayers that I say for people in the program and out. I go to the gym every day, almost. I go 3 days and take a day off. I'm going to be 70 years old in April. I've never felt better in my life. You know, I cannot say enough about the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me how to love myself, you know, when I was not capable of doing that. I had no self-esteem. I hated myself. I didn't like what I did. My career consisted of peaks and valleys. You know, I always wanted to achieve, probably to please my mother, who was such an asshole anyway, and never could. So every time I got up there, I'd make sure I went down there. You know, every time I got up there, I went on a jury verdict one afternoon for $2.3 million, and I was driving a car that had no battery. So I got the car started, and I drove it out to a bar, a local bar. I left the car running while I went in there and contacted my dealer and drank for 4 or 5 hours, and then I took a cab home. And I came back the next day, and of course that car wouldn't start because there was no battery in it. Now there was no gas in it either. That's the way my thinking was when I was drinking and using. My thinking is not that way anymore. You know, I want to be sure and thank you for the lovely meal. I don't know how that works, if the group pays for that or you do, but yeah, we went to Crawdaddy's and just got a great meal tonight. Thank you very much, and thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.